The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Imagine your home totally organized with Closets by Design. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BY-DESIGN.
Hello, and welcome to a brand new best podcast in baseball. This week, I'm going to talk with freelance journalist Brad Lefton, and we're going to talk not only about the great Hall of Fame career of Ichiro and Japanese baseball in general, but we're going to get into whether or not the Cardinals can overcome their geography and make a play and be a factor in some of the great talent coming from Japan. I'm very excited to have Brad on the show. So enough prelude, cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by freelance journalist Brad Lefton, who works in both English and Japanese to cover baseball. You may have seen his byline in a lot of different places, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, there with The Athletic, and in Cardinals Magazine. If you subscribe to Cardinals Magazine, you've seen his work there. Over in Japan, he does work for NHK and The Number. Brad, thank you so much. You're based here in St. Louis, but is that where I find you? Are you in St. Louis, or are you abroad? Are you having an adventure somewhere?
Today or in general?
All right, fair. Today.
Today.
The podcast itself is an adventure. Yes, okay, I get it.
Today, I am happily at home in St. Louis, yes. Thank you for having me, Derek.
All right, we are talking, as you reminded me, it's on rushing, kind of like the throw itself, the 24th anniversary of the laser beam throw by Hall of Famer Ichiro. How many of these, so I want to ask you about that play. We'll get in and just what you recall of it and how much work you've done to like talk to the people involved in it, Ron Washington, Terrence Long, Ichiro himself. But first, what's this month plus going to be like, 2 months, I guess we are now, in the run up to Ichiro's induction into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown? What is that going to look like? I mean, how is it just like one big year of fanfare to celebrate this great career?
Well, it's you know what? It's really an interesting question, and it's a question that kind of gets to the core of why I love doing what I do, because of the cultural differences and the cultural insights that you gain. You know, you think you have a pretty solid understanding of things until you get into the way another culture looks at at your own culture. And it is, yes, there's excitement building in Japan. Yes, it's already been a busy year for me. I've been to Cooperstown already once. I'm going next week.
I'll be going in July.
So, yes. But what's really interesting about it is I think that everybody, you know, just assumes that it's going to be the biggest turnout ever for an induction ceremony, because so many Japanese fans are going to come, and that Japan is going bonkers over the first Japanese player to be inducted into the American Baseball Hall of Fame. And I think in the end, that will be true. But what we are discovering is that because there is a Hall of Fame in Japan, they have their own Hall of Fame, but the stature of the Hall of Fame in our country and in their country is very different. So I think because Ichiro is the first to go into ours, it's not really understood what is the meaning of this. What's the significance of this? What's the historical, you know, the relevance of the Hall of Fame in American culture and American baseball? So the January event, which was the announcement that he was one of the electees, got heavy coverage as a news story. Mm-hmm. But the July induction ceremony, I think people in Japan are still, having trouble wrapping their arms around what's the significance of that. Okay, it's already been announced that he's in. And so what's the great significance of a speech? Why do we need to be excited about that? But so the excitement will build. And then after it's all over, people will begin to understand. And then certainly the next Japanese player who goes in, they will all have gotten it. But right now there's still a learning curve going on.
What takes you to Cooperstown here in the coming week? Is it part of bridging that? Is that part of what you're headed there to do? Or is there a specific story that you're chasing?
Well, actually, it's possible that I'll be going twice in the coming weeks. So from the Ichiro perspective, the Ichiro induction perspective, there are a series of, little milestone events that happen between the announcement and the induction. One of those is upcoming, which is the Hall of Fame builds a special case for each of the that year's inductees, and they have an unveiling of the case, and so that's a news story, and so I will likely be going there when we find out exactly when the Ichiro case will be unveiled. The other reason that I'm going on a separate trip, which is already set, is that the Hall of Fame is unveiling a major exhibit this July in the timing it to Ichiro's induction on the history of exchange through baseball between the U.S. and Japan.
Oh, and fantastic.
Yes, it is fantastic. And I have been, I'm a consultant to the Hall of Fame on this exhibit. So I am being brought up to Cooperstown in a couple of weeks to continue the consultancy as they get very close to unveiling this really fantastic exhibit. And I should also give a plug to St. Louis's very own Tom Schieber, who is one of the lead curators in Cooperstown and native St. Louisan, and somebody that I'm working very closely with on this project.
Fell in love with baseball because of a baseball he found there in U City. So yeah, the yet another guy with St. Louis ties who is connected to baseball at the highest level there in Cooperstown. All right, so the laser throw. All right, what? Let's relive this. Tell me about it. Why does it persist in Ichiro lore? There's so many things he did, but all right. Take me through all of it. Set the stage for what happened and then why it continues to be a story to revisit.
Well, when we scheduled this recording, and I thought, oh my gosh, this might be the 24th anniversary of the laser beam throw. And I looked it up and I was off by 2 days. It was April 11th that Ichiro was 8 games into Ichiro's major league career that he made his iconic throw from right field to nab Terrence Long, who was trying to go first to third on a single to right. And Ichiro made a laser beam throw that then Terrence Long was out by a couple of strides. And it's an iconic play that lives on today. You still see that from time to time on the internet and on television. And it was really the first image, I think, that defined Ichiro and Ichiro's greatness. And I like it for many, many reasons. But one of the reasons is that, he's a 3,000 hit member, but the first image really of Ichiro in this country is of that throw and of his defense. And he's so proud of all facets of the game that he excelled at, not just the hitting. And so to have that iconic throw be the first play that really defined his career here, I think also kind of just defines his greatness and his all-around brilliance. Another thing that I really like about that play that I think people don't realize when you see the image, you wouldn't know this by just watching the image, But in that game, he made that throw in the eighth inning, I believe, and he had just come into the game. So that was the first time that he touched the ball all day. And so the very first ball that comes to him is that throw.
Yeah.
So it really tells you the kind of preparation that he puts into his game to come in that prepared to make that throw.
I'm trying to put myself back in the mind's eye of a baseball fan at that time. And everything that was talked about and discussed and described about Ichiro coming over was what a gifted and sublime hitter he was, especially in the era of like just sheer amount of hits. I think of like Tony Gwynn, right? Who was, you know, already there, and George Brett to a certain extent, you know, guys who just, you're like, man, these folks are getting a lot of hits. And Ichiro was like expected to outdo them all. You know, I mean, I don't remember how soon after his arrival, his name was linked to George Sisler, but it sure seemed like it was before he ever took a run at Sisler's record and then broke it. And then of course, as you say, that like you think of him as a hitter and just this excellent high average, going to take a run at 400, that kind of Ted Williams, you know, big numbers type of stuff. And then it's a defensive play. You're right. I love the fact that it gives this full rounded view of his talent. And maybe, Brad, a window into, or maybe the beginning of the window, is this fair, into how we see his love of baseball, like that it's just all around.
Yes, I think that's really a fair statement. Yes, so I think it's even important to him that was the play that really woke America up to him, instead of being a hit. And actually, that was game eight in game four, I believe, their first road game at Texas. He homered in the 10th inning, and they won that game in 10 innings. So he hit a homer in his fourth game. I mean, what turned out to be a game winning homer in his fourth game of his career. But, you know, everybody hits homers here, but not everybody throws Terrence Long out trying to stretch first to third, eight games into their career. So, yeah. So he's proud of all aspects of his game. So to have that one be the one that defined his entrance into American baseball, I think is something that he's very proud of.
You know, he's one of the players, maybe even the leader, as far as active players who have visited Cooperstown. I think most folks, you know, and they may actually, maybe they don't know the story of him visiting Sisler's grave here in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah, at the 2009 All-Star game. He broke George Sisler's 84-year record, I believe, of most hits in a season. George Sisler had 257 hits. And in 2004, Ichiro recorded 262 hits. So, and the Sisler family was very kind in traveling to Seattle to be on hand when he broke the record. George Sisler's daughter and a couple of his grandsons and great grandchildren were on hand. So Ichiro felt that he needed to return the respect shown to him when the All-Star game was in St. Louis in 2009, and he went out to, I guess that would that be Ledoux? Would it be Kirkwood? Would it be on Guyer Road? There's a very tiny cemetery on Guyer Road, and kind of almost in a neighborhood, and George Sisler is laid to rest there, and Ichiro brought a beautiful bouquet of flowers and placed it at his gravesite and paid his respects. Yes.
Sisler, a great St. Louis Brown, who set the record while he was with the American League team here in St. Louis. I was recently watching some Ichiro videos because that's what one does. And he caught a ceremonial first pitch not too long ago. He caught it. And this is years after he retired, but he caught it and he was in full uniform as he did it. And I remember that, like, we were there. This has to be a decade ago, maybe. No, couldn't have been a decade ago, but it was shortly after he retired. And we were there in, and you were there as well, the Mariners Cardinals series. And he was out in right field, like as if he was warming up for a game. He was in the gear and everything. And I was like, oh, please say it's so that we're going to see him play. But he's always around the game. How does that, you know, I mean, I'll tell my favorite, one of my favorite stories, but I want to get yours first, is that, like, how does that manifest in your conversations with him? Like, and through the years, you know, how does he still surprise you with how connected and how just curious he is with even like historic baseball and modern baseball?
Well, first I will say you'll get to relive that treat if you are on the Cardinals trip to Seattle in early September, because he's still out there every single home game.
It's so great.
He will be.
He could still throw out Terrence Long. It looks like.
Yes, he could.
It looks like he's out there getting ready to throw out Terrence Long.
He absolutely could. when you are there in early September for the Cardinals series at the Mariners, he will be roughly 6 weeks out from his 52nd birthday. Wow. And he still is the throwing partner, the daily throwing partner for home games and at all every day in spring training for Julio Rodriguez. So Julio Rodriguez recognizes the value of having somebody like Ichiro around, and he's asked Ichiro to be his throwing partner, and Ichiro can air it out almost further than anybody else preparing to play in that night's game. And then not only is that a treat to watch before every home Mariners game, but it's also a treat if you continue watching the interaction between Ichiro and Julio, that Julio actually asks Ichiro meaningful baseball questions, especially about defense, and has learned, you know, has just picked up awesome. So many tips from Ichiro. It really is awesome, because I don't think that everybody likes having Ichiro around. He's fun. He's funny. They all like joking with him. They all like his presence on the field. But I think that it's really special that Julio recognizes how he can be an asset to him, how he can enhance his career. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't think that other players, although they enjoy having him around, can actually understand how he can be a valuable resource.
This job, we're so fortunate to, you know, in 2001, I'm covering, I guess, the NBA and then hockey, and I'm such a fan of baseball. But like baseball greats, you don't really know until you get into the job how those interactions are going to be. You know, somewhat there's a hesitance there of don't meet your heroes kind of thing. But one of the things I do treasure about having been so fortunate to cover baseball for a long time is Ichiro once brought that up to me, that I was interviewing him and he goes, well, you've been around the game a long time. And I was like, oh, that is like just one of the biggest compliments that I could ever get from anyone. And then the other is you get to see his sense of humor. Which we were lucky enough to see sometimes at a distance, sometimes close by when he was with the Marlins during spring training. And I don't, you know, it's awesome. It was a great treat to have those interactions. Brad, how much credit should he get for the game as we see it right now, for the absolute excellence and arrival of not just singular talents, but a group of talents from Japan, from Asia into the game. And they're their stars, one of whom, of course, Otani, maybe the best to ever play the game. How much credit should he get, does he get, for creating that expressway and that connection?
I think he deserves a lot of credit, and I think he deserves a lot of credit in two ways. One, which is not readily recognized. So the first is, obviously, he was the first position player to come from Japan in 2001. So imagine the pressure that is on him, because if he's a failure, it's does the next one come? The next one probably comes, but does the next one come a year later in Sō Taguchi? Does the next one come after that, the following year in Hideki Matsui? Or do we have a lull before we see the next one come? So he was an instant success. And believe me, he prepared in a way, mentally, physically, to be I shouldn't say to be a success, because that's not the right word. He prepared mentally and physically to play as close to 100% of his ability as he could in his very first year, in his very first game. And so because of that, he recognized that pressure, that if he did not succeed, it would be a setback for Japanese baseball. He was a smashing success. He won Rookie of the Year in 2001. He set the single season rookie hits record with 242 hits that year. He won a Gold Glove. He started the All-Star game. So he was a smashing success in every way. And the Mariners won 116 games that season, a record, and they made the playoffs that year. The second way that I think that he also deserves a lot of credit, which he probably doesn't get, is that Ichiro played in the inaugural World Baseball Classic tournament in 2006 when this was a new concept, and so many players, especially in this country, were very uncertain about the WBC. And as you remember, in the first couple of WBCs, American players were very hesitant to participate because how it would affect their spring training. That's the WBC is held in March. Ichiro participated in the very first one and in the second one, and Japan won the first one and the second one. And I think that really gave a lot of Japanese players the experience of seeing that, hey, we do have a way of competing with players outside of Japan. And I think Ichiro led that charge and deserves a lot of credit for that. I mean, if you look at players, the number of players who came over before the first WBC and before even the second WBC, and the number of players who have come since, it's dramatically different.
Soon after Ichiro came over, the Cardinals signed Sō Taguchi. He was a big part of a World Series team, beloved figure here in St. Louis. His people probably forget his career got off to a rocky start. He was a little bit overwhelmed right away, but then became such a contributor to the team, started World Series games, had a big hit that helped them win a pennant, all of that. And as you do, I'm glad you brought that up, as you do that exhibit with the National Baseball Hall of Fame, you know, there are Cardinals elements, I would imagine, of that, because the Cardinals were involved in, well, the Cardinals themselves as world champions went over and did a tour in Japan. Sada Araujo hit against the Cardinals. I think he hit a home run, at least one home run against the Cardinals. Stan Musial played in Japan representing the Cardinals. So the Cardinals have like this tie to baseball and the history of baseball and this connection between the two countries, which brings me to the present. Brad, how do the Cardinals get back in the game with this? You know, they have a scout there. They have put a lot of money, and Matt Slater has championed scouting the area. They brought players back. Miles Michaelis is a two-time All-Star that they brought back from Asia. They saw Yamamoto as an opportunity for them, that then they quickly realized, holy cow, that auction is going to go crazy and way out of their price range, way out of what they thought. They seem somewhat resigned to the fact that because of where they're situated geographically, they don't have a strong sales pitch. What do they do? The floor is yours.
Is this a job interview?
So here's what it is. Some of the Cardinals execs, they wanted me to bring you in here. They're going to listen to this. And when they put the, you know, a few minutes into your explanation, they're going to put the ear pods down and they're going to call you and offer you a job. I mean, they're in a real bind, right? I mean, am I missing something? And some of it is of their own making, but some of it is just of the globe, you know, the geography of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Mariners and the Yankees and the Mets, and the Dodgers, of course, were early on to Japanese players coming over, and the Mariners got Ichiro early on, and then they continued. They had a long, long history. In fact, that they had, I think, boy, I'll bet the Mariners went from about 19, well, they had Kaz Sasaki in 1999, and they probably had a Japanese player on the roster every year up until from 99 until Iwakuma went back to Japan. So maybe 2017, something wow. like that, uninterrupted. Yeah. So, but even a history like that with the Mariners has not landed them. Shohei Ohtani as a free agent has not landed them. Yamamoto has not landed them. Sasaki Roki. So, and the Yankees were very active, and the Yankees have the pocketbook, but they have not signed a Japanese free agent from Japan since Tanaka in 2014. Wow. So, so it's not just a Cardinals or a geography issue.
It's a Dodgers thing.
It's it is partly becoming a Dodgers thing, but I think that a team like the Cardinals in the middle of the country for sure can compete for talent from Japan. I think that, you know, like the Cubs have recently signed Seiya Suzuki, and then they followed that up with Shota Imanaga. What's the Cubs pitch? The Cubs pitch certainly to Imanaga, not so much to Suzuki, but I think one of the reasons that helped them land Imanaga was what they learned by having Suzuki on the team, and things that were important to Japanese players, such as having a Japanese trainer on staff or a Japanese masseuse, having putting thought into team nutrition from a Japanese perspective. So by the time the Cubs were courting Imanaga, they had already, you know, updated the nutrition in the clubhouse to add a Japanese perspective to it. They have a Japanese trainer and a masseuse, I think. They already had a Japanese speaker, more than one Japanese speaker on staff. And so, you know, these are little things, but when you're making your pitch and the player is comparing offers, it's nice to be able to say, oh, well, they do have this over here. what separates this offer from this offer? I mean, this team has shown that they're willing to be sensitive to issues that are important to Japanese players. So, you know, it's a small thing. scouting in Japan, having a scouting presence in Japan is, I think, is an important thing. And the Cardinals, the Cardinals do have that. I don't know how significant it is. Also having the Major League Club having a presence in Japan. You know, when Sasaki Roki, who the Dodgers signed this year, threw his no-hitter in Japan a couple of years ago. I think that was the game. Maybe I'm mixing up Sasaki and Yamamoto, but there was a significant event, and I'm thinking it was Sasaki's no-hitter, that Brian Cashman happened to be in the stands, and there's video of at the end of this performance, Brian Cashman is standing up and applauding the pitcher. So, you know, I don't believe that besides Matt Slater that the Cardinals have had any front office executives travel to Japan themselves to see these players. And I think that, you know, that other teams that they are competing with for the talent have, and that's just another little thing that's significant, but look,
it was Yamamoto. It was the Cashman. Cashman saw Yamamoto's no hitter.
Oh.
He was not the only executive at that game. He was not the only MLB executive at the game. I believe the Cardinals did not have, you know, obviously Mozeliak wasn't there and Gersh wasn't there. Cardinals did have somebody there that day, but a lot of teams did. At one point in time, Cashman, remember they stashed a number for him, which was not a small thing, that the Yankees put aside Yamamoto's number so that they could have it available to him, which again, I mean, all right, well, that sounds fine and everything, but that's not a small thing for the Yankees, because I think the number was low and they have so many retired numbers, and that it was an appealing number, but they set it aside so that when he was available, they could offer it to him. Didn't work out, obviously. But that was one of the early stages of it dawning on the Cardinals that, yeah, this ain't happening.
But I think that geography is certainly important. I mean, certainly there's a lot of appeal to a Japanese player to go to Seattle, Los Angeles, San Diego, where you are, where there's heavy Japanese population, there's Japanese food, there's direct flights, you know, relatively easy flights direct back to Japan. But that said, Tampa has done a nice job of signing Japanese free agents, and they've made themselves an attractive destination. The Orioles signed Sugano this year. So it's very possible for the Cardinals to get back in that arena.
So the Cardinals have to sell infrastructure, right? Okay.
Yes.
And they would have to build that out, because, you know, like, can the Cardinals capitalize at all on their two strongest connections, which, or maybe three, their three strongest connections? First of all, Sho Taguchi, right? Lars Nootbaar has a high profile in Japan. Does that benefit them at all? Does that make their logo prominent? Does that do anything there? And somewhat, maybe to a lesser extent, you know, the success Michaelis had coming back. Do any of those things help them in that regard?
They all help in a small way. I think that, you know, especially with Sho Taguchi, that if the Cardinals were keenly interested in playing in the Japanese market, it would have, I always thought it would have really been an interesting idea to see if they could invite Sho Taguchi into Cardinals spring training for, you know, a 2-week stint as a guest instructor while he was coaching in Japan. He just stepped away from coaching. I think he coached and managed for 8 or 9 seasons, but just stepped away before this season. But, you know, I think that it's very conceivable that So's Oryx team would have allowed him or would have considered a relationship like that. And, you know, it's just creative things like that, that they're small, but they open up doors. Other, you know, and Yamamoto was pitched for Soh's Oryx team. So,
well,
you know,
so that's so, that's part of this.
Yes.
Yeah, as the Cardinals had that business relationship with Oryx, right? And they worked really hard to foster it. There were some executives from Oryx who came over. There was cooperation between the two executive groups at times. Matt Slater fostered that. You know, Matt Slater is one of the few people in baseball in the world with championship rings from, you know, both here and also there because of his work with Oryx. So the Cardinals had all this, and then they didn't really benefit from it. And then MLB put the kibosh on it because they didn't want even the hint of impropriety, which give me a break. Like, I mean, it's at this point, at that point, it was kind of silly, right? Like, the Cardinals had this long fostered relationship. I mean, it was many years that they had done this with Oryx. They don't sign the guy. The Dodgers, who everybody thought was going to sign everybody anyways, they do. And then the rules come down hard on a team like the Cardinals.
Right.
It was like, I mean, that's kind of the crux of it, right? Like, they could do that because it was the Cardinals, and the Cardinals weren't going to be an appealing team for a lot of different reasons, or because of their location or because of their city. And so it was easy to come down hard on them. That would have been a whole lot more difficult if they all of a sudden said, hey, Seattle, you can't have that business arrangement with Oryx to like mutually promote each other and all that stuff. That would have been a whole lot harder. And it seems like, you know, there are some steep hills for the Cardinals to get over, that even when they try to do something that makes them a presence, they end up sliding backwards.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. That was really a setback, because Matt Slater did such a wonderful job of really integrating himself into, you know, the Oryx club. He was. I would run into him there in spring training at Oryx. Then during the season here in St. Louis, you would have Oryx scouts and team officials coming to St. Louis to visit Matt Slater and to talk to the Cardinals. And it was just, you know, just having that dialogue and having that presence is a helpful thing. And now it's MLB put the kibosh on it. And it's,
I mean, I don't even know how to put it. Like, one of the things I talked with a longtime sports writer and author, and he told me that one of the things he likes to do is when he sees crowd photos, right, at the Vatican or at the Olympics or, you know, things like that, crowd photos, is look for the baseball caps and what logos there are. And inevitably, you see a lot of Yankee hats. But there for a while, or in some countries, you're going to see Boston hats. You know, the Cardinals had, you know, they had strong presence, whether that was because of themselves or because of musicians who would wear their hat, right, and make it part of the style, or the beer that came from St. Louis that then people would find out about the interlocking STL, any number of reasons. But the Cardinals weren't absent from the photo, right? Are the Cardinals absent from, I mean, where do they fit in the marketplace? You know, Lars helps in some way, but it's Lars, and it's probably Lars from Team Japan more than it is Lars of the St. Louis Cardinals. Are the Cardinals even in the conversation there when it comes to marketing?
Well, it's the answer to that question is different today than it was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, because nobody other than the Dodgers right now are in the conversation.
Oh, okay. Everything
is, everything is Ohtani, Dodgers. But the Cardinals will be in the conversation, you know, 6 days during the season, the three games that the Dodgers play here and the three games the Cardinals play.
Well, there you go.
Well,
three years ago, were they? That's a great point.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the Dodgers have become such a juggernaut. They just are a cultural juggernaut in every fashion. They have broken the game, There's no other way around it. And kudos to them. I mean, it's incredible what they've done. And that is true not only on the field, but off the field as a business. They are, they're baseball's best business ever. It's incredible. But the Angels, when they had Shohei, were the Angels, they weren't as popular as the Dodgers are now. So what was that like 3 years ago? I mean, was there more oxygen for other teams?
Probably a little more, but the Angels were, you know, I mean, Ohtani was still infinitely popular in Japan, and every Ohtani game as an Angel was broadcast in Japan. And you go to Japan and you see Angels caps and Angels t-shirts all over the place. But interestingly, now that, you know, so what's the staying power of that? You know, was it the Angels really popular in Japan? No, Shohei was popular in Japan, and that happened to be the logo he's wearing. And now that he's wearing a different logo, and and he's not wearing that one, that one is not, you know, is not nearly as popular. Now Kikuchi, they signed Kikuchi this year, so they'll get a little bump in popularity. Yeah,
saw him pitch in St. Louis. Well, what about the Mariners? Are the Mariners popular, or is Ichiro popular?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think that is more popular than the Mariners brand, but I think because the Mariners, as earlier, had like a 20-year run of having at least one Japanese player on the team, that the brand has some staying power in Japan. And Ichiro is still connected with the Mariners. Sure, he's still there helps. At every home game, so that helps, yes.
How are the Cubs helped by playing over there? Do you think that the Cubs will get a bounce from having gone over there to be a foil for the Dodgers for a few days?
Yeah, I'm wondering how many people noticed that the Cubs were the opponent.
But, really?
But, no, I mean, I say that in jest, because there are Suzuki Seiya fans, and there are Imanaga fans in Japan, and Japanese fans were very happy to see them and to see Imanaga pitch at the Tokyo Dome. But, you know, the Dodgers could have played the Rockies, and I think the Tokyo Dome would have been sold out.
Sure.
For that series. But, you know, I think that the Cubs have done a very nice job of raising their profile in Japan, and, you know, Imanaga's starts get televised back to Japan, and they follow what Suzuki's daily batting and Imanaga's starts. And I think they've made themselves into an attractive choice for other Japanese players wanting to come because of the little things that they have done to show that they recognize what's important to a Japanese player.
Would playing in Japan help the Cardinals? Would just appearing there, would that help in that way?
I mean, I think it doesn't hurt, but I think at this point, without a Japanese player, the Cardinals going to Japan are just going to be, as you said, the foil for. They're not going to be the draw, right? It's going to be the Dodgers versus the Cardinals, or it's going to be the Padres versus the Cardinals, or it's going to be a team that has prominent Japanese players looking for an opponent. And so, is that the way the Cardinals want to do it? It doesn't hurt, but it's not as big as being the team that has the draw.
Do you think I'm going to ask you to put your prediction cap on, and I struggle with it too, so I empathize if this puts, you know, if this is a difficult question to ask or to answer. I mean, do you think they have a chance to sign a talent from Japan in the coming years? Like, are we talking here the best podcast in baseball's 23rd year, and they've finally made it? I mean, is there any indication that they have a chance?
Absolutely. I mean, they were in on Matsui, the Matsui reliever who went to the Padres.
Yeah, he came
to St. Louis. He was impressed with what he saw. He discussed with So Taguchi about life in St. Louis. He was interested in St. Louis. Now, and it wasn't, you know, it came down to what it comes down to for domestic players, the offer. And the Padres were able to make a better offer, I think, in terms of dollars and years, I believe. And the Padres also had the intangible of having Yu Darvish already on the team.
Right.
Most Japanese pitchers really want to be a teammate of Yu Darvish. So it's tough to turn that down.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it kind of sounds like what would help the Cardinals is to sign a player maybe who's been in the big leagues already, leave that player with a good impression, and then build around that player from Japan as he's here. Like, that seems like a way for them to maybe jumpstart their presence, is to, if you aren't able to sign someone, you know, to bring them over, find somebody who's already here and is a free agent. And go that way.
Yep. And they, you know, we both know the Cardinals work at the forefront of signing Japanese players from Japan. They signed So Taguchi as the third position player, only the third position player from Japan in 2002. They've never signed another player from Japan, nor have they acquired one who's already been here in a trade. But, you know, I mean,
that's remarkable.
Yeah.
But they did have success with the KBO. You know, Sungwon Oh came over. He was very good for the Cardinals. There's no other way around that. He was quite good for the Cardinals. Gungyun Kim came over and just, he was so much better than the situation. That was just such a, you can really feel for that. He pitched very well and was thrown into a very untenable spot, in the sense that the world shut down. You think about how when the Cardinals opened even the shortened 2020 season, he was the closer on day one. That's not why he signed with the Cardinals. He did not sign to be the closer. He signed to be a starter. And then within a week was a starter because of an injury. He didn't really have the opportunity to be at his best with the Cardinals, and he deserved it. He put everything into it. And when he did pitch, he pitched well. But you're right. I mean, that's a remarkable stat, Brad, is that they haven't had anyone since So Taguchi. They were one of the first, and now they're just behind. That's crazy.
Yeah. But they have done a nice job of signing Americans who have resurrected their careers in Japan, right? We've had Miles Michaelis, we had Drew Verhagen, we've had who else? We've had a handful of those guys.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you about Drew. You recently, so Drew Verhagen came over to the Cardinals. He had an interesting time with the Cardinals. Let's just put it that way. He's about 5 hours shy of being named one of the starters, and then went out and pitched a clunker in spring training. And everyone says, you know, they all insist, every team insists you don't make decisions based solely on spring training. You don't fall in love in March. You don't fall, you know, all of that. You don't fall out of love in March, all that stuff. You got to use bigger sample sizes. And inevitably, some decision on the 26-man roster comes down to, like, something that happened in the previous 72 hours. It's just, it cracks me up every year. And you know that, you know, teams fight their instincts. And maybe even when they do make decisions on the larger scale, they fight the narrative instincts to say it happened within the past 72 hours. But there was one that was like, oh gosh, what the heck happened? But Verhagen is back, and right, he went back to Japan. He pitched for the Cardinals for a bit. Didn't really get the toehold back on his career here. But you spoke to him about going back to Japan and why.
So the 2 years that he was in St. Louis, I would often talk to him about Japanese baseball, and every conversation would include a line about how he really hoped that he could go back to Japan one day and play there again. He really enjoyed his experience there, and he was able to fulfill that wish by returning last year, signed with the team that he had originally played for in Japan, the Nippon Ham Fighters. He's there again this year, and he's there as a starter. So I'm sure that's part of the reason that that it's attractive to him, that they see him as a starter. He's in their rotation right now. But he also, he just really liked the lifestyle, and he and the stadium that they built in Sapporo for the Fighters is, people who have seen it, I have not. It's opened about, I'm going to say, about 2-3 years ago, Escon Field. And people say it's the finest ballpark in the world, not in Japan, in the world. And I have seen images of it, and was talking to Drew about it when I was in spring, in his spring training this year. And he was just telling me that, like, that he has not been in the home clubhouse in Texas, but of all of the clubhouses that he has been in Major League Baseball, the home clubhouse at the Fighters Escon Field in Sapporo is the finest clubhouse he's ever been in. Wow. The facilities for the players. And this is really a surprise in Japan, because many of the ballparks in Japan are Spartan. The locker rooms are cramped. The facilities are less than here, but the Fighters saw the Fighters, they sent, for years they were sending a contingency to the States to look at ballpark design, and twice they came to St. Louis and they looked at Busch Stadium, they looked at Ballpark Village, and they have incorporated a Ballpark Village type concept in their stadium design.
Really interesting.
In Japan, yes, it's really fascinating, and it is on my very, very short list of places that I have to visit when I'm in Japan. But the problem is I rarely go to Japan in season. So it's, you know, I would have to go in season to see Escon Field. But anyway, getting back to Drew, he wanted to go back to Japan. We were talking about, you know, how has he evolved as a pitcher from the Japan experience? And one of the things that he says that's really interesting is that, you know, the running game is so prevalent in Japan, and everybody can, not only can everybody in the lineup run, but when a runner, you know, runners steal second, even if you've got a home run batter, at the plate, or that's everybody is looking to run, and they're not changing their game based on who's at the plate. So he had this big delivery, and people were running wild on him. And they said to him, "Look, you really got to learn the slide step. You've really got to be effective at controlling the run game, because it's very different here than it is in Major League Baseball." So he's really worked on that. He's only had two starts this season, but when I was there in spring training, you could see him working on that in the bullpen. And then we talked about it, and he just talked about how important it was to control the running game there, so much more so than here, because it really affects you.
Wow. Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining me and talking through this. I want to close with the last, just as we've talked through this, that something has been in my mind this whole time. It's more about you. And I wonder, like, did you come at this with a love of baseball and then an experience and an appreciation in Japan? And this is where it melded. Did one lead you to the other? How has this happened for you, that you've stitched these two things together? And did one interest lead to the other, or was it always kind of an alloy, if you will, for you?
Well, I've always been interested in baseball. I grew up, you know, a baseball fan in St. Louis. It's hard to grow up in St. Louis and not be a baseball fan and have that in your blood. But then And I worked at KMOX Radio. I interned at KMOX Radio for a long time through high school and college. And so when I went to Japan, which I just went on a whim to visit a friend, I had no interest in Japan and never studied Japan in college, anything like that. It was Bob Costas who had a syndicated radio show out of St. Louis at the time called Costas Coast to Coast. Mm-hmm. And when I was extending my stay in Japan, he said, if you could get interviews with the Americans playing in Japan, we could use that on the show. And so that was all I needed to figure out how to get myself credentialed into a ballpark and interview Americans who were playing baseball in Japan and send him back the tapes. And just one thing led to another, you know, and then Nomo comes, and all of a sudden Japan is infinitely interested in our game, and they have nobody really positioned to help them cover the Major League Baseball. So I was in the right place at the right time a couple of times.
That's amazing. KMOX is considered the first U.S. station to broadcast a baseball game, from Japan, because it's interesting. There's like a whole history there, and the history includes the fact that the Post-Dispatch hired a Cardinal to cover games. One of the pitchers on the team touring Japan, the Post-Dispatch
in 1958 when they went on the 58 tour.
Huh. Yeah, with they hired a pitcher to write back. And would write these amazing stories, like very, very witty, you know, like offhanded remarks about how much they drank and couldn't find their hotel room because the hotel room didn't have numbers. It had, you know, it was named after flowers and they couldn't remember what flower their hotel room was, you know. And so and KMOX was one of the first. So, yeah, it's just a fascinating history there that ties St. Louis baseball to Japan's baseball and you're part of that. That's fat. That's great.
Well, that can great. I,
it's so cool.
Can I tell you another, do you have time for another story that you will be interested in? Because I know you like comics and I have never shown this to you, but now I'm going to bring it to the ballpark with me the next time. Okay. So there is, so in the late 60s, there was a baseball comic in Japan called Kyojin no Hoshi. It's one of the very most popular, culturally significant baseball comics, manga, and it became anime in Japan. You know, like young people today might not be that familiar with it, but in its time, and it had a very long run, and so Kyojin no Hoshi is about a star pitcher who develops this, what he calls a big league ball, and the ball dipsy doodles and confounds batters and goes, you know, and dipsy doodles all over the place, and and so he's the star, and so in the middle of the series, the Cardinals come to Japan, and so in the comic, the actual Cardinals are in. Red Shandies is the manager. It says Shandies on his.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Lou Brock is there. Bob Gibson is there. Kurt Flood is there. They're all in the comic. They all go to Japan and are integrated into the comic. Then one Cardinal remains in Japan when the team goes back, and it's the fictitious Armstrong Ozuna.
Okay.
Armstrong Ozuna is a combination of two things that they did not see in Japanese baseball at the time: Lou Brock and Bob Gibson. He is this imposing, you know, invokes fear in the opponents with his expressions, and he's also fast. He's a hitter, and he becomes the main rival for the rest of the series to Kyojin no Hoshi. And so he was a Cardinal who now becomes a domestic Japanese league player, but he's in a Cardinal uniform. And so when So Taguchi came to St. Louis in 2002,
yeah,
and he's met Red Shandies, he was like, oh, what? There's a real Red Shandy. There was, wait, are you the same guy who was in the comic book?
That is amazing.
Yeah.
All this time we're talking about like the Cardinals' place there, and they have this like this spot, this historic thing, and the missed opportunity. You know, but maybe they can kindle that again. Maybe, you know, they'll be the grandkids of the people who read that comic. who will go like, well, I'm going to be a Cardinal. Wow. Fantastic. I got to see this. I'm very excited to see this.
I'm going to bring it with me next time I go to the ballpark.
That's awesome. I cannot wait. All right. So add that. So my goal is to someday go to a game in Japan with you. I would love that. It's been since you and I started talking, since we've had dinners in different places with very, very memorable dinner in Seattle. I'm like, all right, I would love to go to a game in Japan, and I would love most of all to like to be there with Brad and to see it with your guidance and enjoy it that way. I hope that happens. I hope it happens sometime.
I hope it happens too, and maybe it will happen at a Cardinals game in Japan. Maybe the Cardinals will play at Escon Field in Sapporo.
There you go. Yeah, we can both see that clubhouse. I don't know, like sitting next to me during a Cardinal game, there's just a whole lot of furious typing, not a whole lot of furious talking. So, it's still being enjoyed. I love it. Brad, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you so much for especially the story at the end, but also kind of taking us through not only what Ichiro means, but how the Cardinals can get back in the game here. If they can at all, it's a really fascinating time, and it's such a celebration of baseball and the global hold that it could have. I think it's so cool. And you know, you get to be a part of that, you know, writing both in Japan and in English and sharing the game in ways that like, well, do you feel, you kind of brought it up, but do you feel in a way that like growing up in St. Louis informs how you write about baseball in both languages?
Sure. I mean, I think because I just think growing up in St. Louis, it's just part of the culture to be a fan of the game and interested in the game and curious about so many facets of the game, the history of the game and other things of the game. So it makes, yeah, I think it makes, you know, like we were just talking about Verhagen, and the story that I wrote about Verhagen is has very little to do with baseball, although it does touch on the the slide step thing, but it has more to do with how he just fell in love with Japan as a place to live and be. And the first 2 years he was there, he was alone because it was the COVID years. And so he couldn't have his girlfriend there. Nobody could visit him. And so he was enjoying this experience, but not able to share it with anybody. And then that was one of the reasons that he wanted to go back, because he wanted to be able to share this with family and friends and his girlfriend. And so his girlfriend came with him last year, and he decided to propose to her in Japan instead of proposing to her some meaningful place in the US, some meaningful place to them in Japan. And now Japan will forever be a part of their sure, togetherness. And that was, so that's really the crux of the story, how he fell in love with Japan and why he chose that location to propose. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that kind of ties to St. Louis, because I think for us, it's more than a game. It's also about the personalities. And we consider, you know, you're just grown up not thinking of these players just as local players on the local team, but you also, I mean, in some ways, think of them as kind of part of your, you know, extended family. Obviously, they're not part of your family, but part of your local family that ties you to this place. And so, yeah.
That's awesome. That is freelance journalist Brad Lefton. Brad, where can people find the Drew Verhagen story?
Well, anybody who can read Japanese can find it on the Sportiva website.
There you go.
Very good. It hasn't come out yet, but it's supposed to come out any day, I believe.
You can find Brad's work. He's written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal. He writes for The Athletic. He's also contributed to the Cardinals magazine, of course, in Japan. His work appears with NHK and in The Number. Brad, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great delight, a great conversation, and I look forward to seeing you at the ballpark.
Hey, Derek, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I hope I didn't bore the audience.
No chance. There's no way that a conversation that ends with a comic book story that involves red shandies bores the audience. It's just that is podcast.
I guess that is true. Yes. I'll give you that. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course, you can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. It's brought to you weekly by Closets by Design of St. Louis. Look for it, rate it, review it, and subscribe to it. Talk to you soon.